Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood up and prayed about himself. God, I thank you that I'm not like other men, robbers and evildoers and adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week and give a tenth of all I get. But the tax collector stood at a distance. He would not even look up to heaven, but beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. I tell you that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted.
As Simon said, my privilege really is to respond to different invitations that come from across the world to come and speak to different groups of people. There's a very often, that can be in any kind of setting, sometimes in a business setting, sometimes in an academic setting, and sometimes to groups of political leaders. And as a matter of fact, I just got back just a few days ago from having spoken to a group of political leaders in a closed session in Asia. And what fascinated me about that was that as I've been able to sort of travel across the world, both from the Western world all the way to the Eastern world, and also in speaking the Northern Hemisphere and also the Southern Hemisphere of this globe, every political group of leaders I have met with during that time have asked me to address the same question. And when you travel across so many different cultures and so many different parts of the world, when you have so many people in senior leadership and they're all asking the same question, they all want you to cover the same ground, it really does get you thinking about what is it that is driving such a diverse range of cultures to all wrestle with the same issue. During that same time, I've also been asked by senior business leaders to also ask try and answer or provide some insight into exactly that same issue as well, that same question. And that question is actually to do with reconciliation. Is it actually possible to affect a meaningful reconciliation of people's hearts and minds in any given culture? Or is that actually something which is beyond us? Now, what is driving this is a huge range of factors, and I can't possibly outline all of them to you. That would take someone of much greater skill and ability than myself and also take up a very large amount of time. But there are a sort of a common set of challenges that are being faced in the major cities around the world which are driving this quest for peace, this quest for reconciliation, this quest to find a way to get right somehow with ourselves and with others, and maybe, if he does exist, ultimately even God. One of those factors which is driving this is to do with how economics has unplayed itself across every major developed and developing economy in the last couple of decades. If you haven't read it, there's a fascinating book by a Frenchman by the name of Piketty, which is entitled just one word, Capital. It's a very large book. It's over 1,000 pages long. It's well worth reading. And not only does it look impressive on the bookshelf, it is really that large that when you die, you could be buried in it. And but what Piketty says, what his central thesis in his book is that in the last few decades, the rate of return on capital has far outstripped the rate of return on income. Now, what does that mean? Well, that basically means that whether you define yourself as working class, middle class, upper middle class, if you are working right now and you have children, teenage children, children in their 20s, the number one question you keep asking yourself again and again and again is, how will my own children, even if they get very good jobs, ever be able to afford their own home? The growth and appreciation of capital assets has been such right across this world, and it's happened at a pace far rate higher, at a far pace, far faster pace than income itself has actually increased, that people are feeling increasingly shut out and isolated from the economy within which they live. They wonder, is it ever possible to be a stakeholder within it? And that rise and that drives a huge sense of questioning, what on earth is going on here? Now, at the same time, not only do we find ourselves faced with a whole set of economic issues, we're also wrestling personally with things that in the past that we maybe thought weren't important, but we're now living with the consequences of them. One of the books that I enjoyed reading most last year was a book entitled Purity by the American author Franzen. And in that book, which is Franzen's third main novel that I've come across. He tends to write a big book about once every 4 to 5 years. He does a lot of research, and he really does think things through very carefully. The heroine of that novel, or probably the heroine isn't the right word, but the central figure of that story, this woman who goes by the nickname of Purity, right at the very beginning of the novel finds herself in a cafe, and she strikes up a conversation with a boy, and she likes him, and very quickly she asks herself the question, dare I risk the intimacy of a friendship with this person, or shall I retreat into the relative safety of casual sex? That's the question she asks herself. Just as this conversation is getting on, just as there's a possibility of relationship there, that's the question she wants to answer. Dare I risk the intimacy of friendship, where I could get hurt, damaged, find myself in pain in some kind of way? Or shall I simply try to isolate myself from that relational side and simply reduce this into the purely physical? Because maybe that will somehow protect me and I will be okay. And really, the rest of the story is a story of her battling with that question and that search for intimacy. We live in a world now where we have lost the distinction and the ability to distinguish between the difference between being physically intimate with a group of people and having relational intimacy with them, and they are not the same. As a matter of fact, you could have all the physical intimacy that you could ever dream of in this world and still find yourself terribly alone. And so we have this sense of personal alienation within. We're struggling to understand also ourselves. We also have huge issues which are driven by what's happening politically in this world right now, as we ask questions now about our political identity. One of the another one of the books that I read earlier this year that really struck a home with me was by a guy called Ishiguro, Japanese author, who's lived in the United Kingdom actually for quite a long time. Again, he tends to publish a novel even slower than Franzen does, about every 5 to 7 years. You may have seen some of his films like Remains of the Day. Anthony Hopkins, any of you have seen that a long time ago? Anyway, as usual, his books are far better than the films. But his latest book is a book entitled The Buried Giant. Now, this book I found fascinating, and it actually got panned by a lot of critics who really didn't like it at all. They felt it was just very slow-moving, it wasn't going anywhere. But actually, I think that his latest novel is an incredible allegory to understand some of the challenges that we face in our world right now. In The Buried Giant, Ishiguro imagines early Christian Britain, early Christianized United Kingdom, or Britain as it then was. But everybody is living in a state of forgetfulness. People literally cannot remember the past. And it starts off with this elderly couple, and they know they're married to each other, but they can't remember how they met, where they met, when they got married, but they know they are married. They can't remember exactly if they have children or not. They think they had children, but they just can't remember. But this state is not unusual to them. Everybody is living in a state of forgetfulness. No one can remember the past. So this couple set off on a quest to recover their memory, to recover the past. And as they set off on this journey, they're joined by a very unlikely group of travelers who are joined to them through a variety of what seem to be very random means, and they set off on this quest to find their past. And eventually, they discover the source of their forgetfulness. And so now the question is, do they recover their memory? Do they do what is required in order to recover their memory? Or do they allow everybody to continue to exist peacefully, but with an inability to remember what's actually happened even just a few weeks ago? And as they sit there debating it, there's a warrior figure who has joined them and is now traveling on the road with them, and the warrior looks at them and he says, if you allow people to recover their memory and they recall the past, quick-tongued men will make ancient grievance rhyme with current complaint, and the result will be war and mayhem. You see what he's saying? He's saying if we remember our past, our history, all those things which divided us, all those things which were done wrong, once we recall our history and we're aware of what got us to this point, we will all turn on each other and we will start killing each other again. So what is better? Better to live peacefully but blissfully unaware of our history, or to recover our sense of history and therefore our identity but actually end up at war? And in that sense, what Ishiguro talks about in his book, The Buried Giant, is one of the great political challenges that you see in this world right now. There isn't a single country, I don't think I've spoken in the last 18 months, that isn't in danger of splitting itself up into multiple countries. And I'm not even just thinking about the recent Scottish referendum we had here in the UK. In the UK, there are currently 6 independence movements. So if they all get their own way in 10 years' time from now, we will actually be 6 different countries. Because Yorkshire, where my father is from, has also got its own independence movement. And indeed, actually, some already think they are living in a different country already. But this is the buried giant. The buried giant that somehow is there. And as we dig it up and bring it up now into the present, it's in danger of destroying us all. How do we find peace and reconciliation in this world? Is it actually possible? Or is it inevitable, as we recall the past, that we will simply be ripped apart in hatred? Now, of course, we're in an incredibly cynical time in our political world right now. When I was speaking in Australia about 6-7 weeks ago, there was a survey which had been done in the country where the question had been asked, do you believe that your political leadership are up to the task of dealing with the major issues facing the country? And in this survey, I think for everyone under the age of 34, over 80% said no. It simply wasn't possible. So at the same time, while we're facing all of these challenges and all of these problems, there's also a growing distrust of what's going on amongst our political leaders and even their ability not alone to understand the problem, but even to start to meaningfully address it, which is why a few months ago in a fascinating editorial in the Financial Times, the author of it said that the greatest issue that we will see in global politics over the next 10 years will not be left versus right, but it will be establishment versus anti-establishment. We're looking for something to change. It doesn't matter how horrendous that change may be, just so long as it's different to what it is now. We're trying to get to a place, but we can't even remember where we've come from. Many, many years ago, a British comedian by the name of Tony Hancock said, "I don't know if it's possible to be nostalgic for a time that never was, but I think I am." We are looking for something. We have lost this sense of peace at every level. We've lost our internal sense of peace, where we feel at home with ourselves, our external sense of peace, where we have peace with others, and this eternal sense of peace. Is it possible to find peace with God? Now, what we often think is that the answer to these kinds of questions is some kind of Herculean effort of our own, that we should put things right, that somehow there is something that we should be able to do, that we should be able to bring about, some process that we can put ourselves to make ourselves right with ourselves, right with other people, and right with God. Now, it's a little bit unfortunate that in the English language, the word self-righteousness is automatically associated with either being conceited or proud or arrogant. And of course, it can be. But it's more than that. Self-righteousness isn't just the idea of a certain attitude, it's also a belief in a certain process. I can make myself right. Things have gone wrong. They need to be put in a good place. I need to regain that sense of peace with myself, regain that sense of peace with others, regain that sense of peace with God. There must be a process I can put myself through to achieve it. That self-righteousness, the opposite of it, in that sense, would be some kind of other righteousness. Well, if I can't fix myself and fix it with other people and fix it with God, I need someone else to come and help. I need someone to do this for me. Now, the scale of the challenge in many ways can't be underestimated. When we talk about our loss of internal peace, that comes to us in a whole variety of ways. My boss, Ravi Zacharias, wrote a children's novel. And in it, he tells the story of this boy and this girl. And the boy had collected a very large jar of marbles, and this girl had collected a very large jar of sweets. And they were talking one day at school, and they thought it would be a fun idea to swap collections. So the very next day, the girl is walking to school with her big jar of sweets, and the boy is walking to school with his big jar of marbles, and they meet just outside the school gate. But as the boy is getting closer to the school gate, he's looking at this jar, and there are a couple of marbles in there that he particularly likes. They're his favorites. So he just looks around, and he puts his hand in, and he takes them out, and he just drops them in his pocket. A few moments later, the young girl comes bounding up with a big smile on her face, and she says, "Oh, you brought the marbles. Here's my sweet collection." And she hands it over. And the boy says, "Well, here are all my marbles." And he hands those over, and they both go home. That night, She sleeps peacefully all through the night. He, however, simply can't get to sleep. He's lying in bed asking himself one question over and over and over again. I'm wondering if she gave me all of her sweets. That loss of internal peace that we experience doesn't simply come from what other people have done to us. It's about what we have done to ourselves. Any self-aware person can recall things that we've done in our lives, things which we have said or did or didn't do, and every time we remember them, we just put our head in our hands and think, oh, I can't believe I did that or I said that or that happened. And we're just aware of this huge sense of loss of internal peace. How can it be made right with us? We have this problem about trying to make peace with other people. One of my colleagues who worked with us for many, many years was a man by the name of L.T. Jayachandran, who was a remarkable speaker and scholar. He could read 17 different languages, although he only ever learned to speak 12 of those fluently, which to me just smacks of intellectual laziness. Because, you know, what's the point of learning to read a language if you can't speak it to anybody? Anyway, he was once addressing a group of leaders in Asia, and he asked all of them to close their eyes and imagine a scenario with him. And he said, I'd like all of you to imagine peace. I want you to imagine a peaceful setting. What does peace look like? And after a couple of minutes, he invited everyone, this group of leaders, to open their eyes and share what they saw. And they all shared. Some talked about snow-capped mountains, others of beautiful meadows filled with wildflowers, others of still lakes, you know, reflecting the clouds or the stars, you know, within the body of water. And even though all of these pictures were different, they all had one thing in common. There were no people in them. Now, isn't that interesting? When asked to imagine what peace looks like, the first thing we do is eliminate everybody else. And this is the challenge for anyone who works in HR anywhere in the world. And then, of course, we ask this question about an eternal sense of peace. Is it possible to find peace with God eternally? Is there such a thing? I don't know how many of you have seen that brilliant philosophical commentary on life in the 20th century, which was called The Simpsons. But if you're not familiar with it, there is one episode where Homer Simpson is walking with God. And he looks up at God and he says, God, why am I here? And God looks at him and says, Homer, I can't tell you that until you die. And Homer says, oh? I said, I can't wait that long. And God says, you can't wait 6 months? Is that when we find the answer to this question? When we rest in peace? Is that when it's finally there? As I said, this is actually something which Jesus speaks to directly. And he actually speaks to it very powerfully. To those who are confident in their own righteousness, in their own belief that somehow they could put themselves right with everybody else and even with God, he told the following parable. Now, in this case, it's very much tied in with the arrogance, which so easily does go with self-righteousness. Because even when we're trying to be humbly self-righteous, it's very difficult, as one former American president discovered, who wrote down a list of moral qualities that he wanted to live out in his life, one of which was to be humble, and realized that no matter how hard he tried, even though he thought he was excelling in all the other things about being charitable and kind and generous and hospitable and so on, that actually the humility one was the one that was really difficult because you couldn't help taking pride in all the achievements that you'd done in all the others. So very often these things do go together, even if it's very subtle. Now, at this point, Jesus then tells a story. Many of you would have heard it before. Two people go up to the temple to pray. They both pray in the temple, and they both leave the temple at the same time. Now, very often, if you've heard this story before, you might be thinking about individual prayer. But this parable isn't just about individual prayer. It's also about public worship. When in Aramaic, or in almost any Semitic language, actually, when you say, I'm going to the temple to pray, that means one of two things. Number one, I'm going to a worship service, okay, like we are here now. Or number two, I'm going to an empty building on its own. This building is very often open during the week. You can come in and you can pray. It's the context that allows you to tell the difference. And it's the context of the prayers that allow us to very safely conclude that what happens here happens in the context of a worship service. They both go to the temple to pray. Now, every morning and every evening at the temple in Jerusalem, there is a service. A lamb is sacrificed for the forgiveness of sins. And after the lamb has been sacrificed for the forgiveness of sins, whichever priest is on duty, it is his turn to go and walk behind a curtain behind him, and he lights incense, and as the incense goes up to heaven, he offers up his prayers to heaven. He prays on behalf of the people outside. Now that's the context for this particular parable. Now why do they offer up their own prayers? Well, when the priest, after this lamb has been sacrificed for the forgiveness of sins, the priest walks off the stage and disappears through the curtain. At that point, the audience are looking at a blank platform. So what do you do? Well, this is the space in the liturgy to offer up your own prayers to God, which is why in Luke chapter 1, it says that when it fell to Zechariah's turn to burn the incense before the Lord, all the people stood outside praying. Okay? In Luke 1:14, well, of course, that's what they do. There's nothing else to do. That makes sense. There's nothing else going on. This is now in the part of the service where you can offer up your own prayers to God. Now, the Pharisee, who sees himself as a very righteous man, and someone who's trying to do everything right, offers up his prayer to God. Now, his prayer has the face of humility about it, because he says, God, I thank you, okay, that I am not like other people. In other words, he says, look, you made me better than everybody else, and I'm just so grateful to you for that. Which is a very interesting way of praying, isn't it? It's almost like a father maybe looking across at a dinner table and looking at one of his slightly difficult children and saying, every time I look at you, I thank God for your mother who looks after you so well. It's sort of like there's like a little sideways edge to that, isn't there? It's not really about them. It's actually about someone else. He's trying to do that unsuccessfully. And then what we have is a list of his qualifications. God, you ask us to do this, and I am doing more than you ask, is what he's saying. God, I am trying the very hardest I can, and as a matter of fact, I'm trying to go above and beyond and do more than you ever asked in order to make sure I'm right with you. And then he says, having talked about how wonderful he is and how much he gives and how great he is and how much better he is by comparison to everyone else, he finishes. Now, there's another guy there, this tax collector. Now, tax collectors have never been particularly popular, and you may know this if you work for the taxation service in any particular country. It's difficult. Now, without going into all of the depth again, which would be required, just to explain about why this man would have been so hated, the key thing is that he's at the same service. He doesn't stand at the front. That's too conspicuous. He stands at the back. He also offers up a prayer, but he doesn't look up to heaven. He looks down. Now, that may seem strange to us today in the Western world, because if you were raised, especially in an Anglican circle, if you went to a traditional Anglican church, you may have noticed this isn't one of those. You have little, you know, cushions sometimes, and the cushions are there. Okay? You put them on the floor, and when he says, let us pray, we all get down on our knees, and we pray, right? And we look down. But if you're Jewish, that's not how you pray. Okay? If you're Jewish, you stand up, you look up to heaven, you open up your hands, and you pray, because God lives up there. If you get down on your knees and you look down there, you're addressing someone else who lives down there, and that typically isn't considered to be God. Does that sort of make sense? Which raises this whole Anglican thing about who we're praying to, but let's not even get into that. That could be controversial in this setting. So that's how you pray if you're Jewish. Which is why we're told this is not how he prays. He feels so ashamed, so unworthy, that he won't look up, he looks down. And then we read that he is so distraught, he beats his breast. Now this is a sign of deep remorse. There's only one other instance that we read in ancient literature of people beating their breasts. And that's actually at the cross of Christ. This is normally how women are considered to express their grief. They beat their breasts in sorrow, but not men. You see it today when you watch the news. If you watch a Middle Eastern funeral today, men, what they do now is they fire guns into the air, okay? And women walk around wailing and they beat their chests and their voices go up and down, and you may have heard it on the news. It's an expression of remorse, but it's normally what women do. But that's how he conducts himself. He is that sorry for the state he is in. And then he prays, God, have mercy on me, a sinner. That's what he prays. Except what he prays is a little bit more technical than that. Now, This passage, which was written in Greek, the Greek word for mercy is eleison. And again, if you've come from a traditional church, you may be familiar with that word because there's a little thing called the Kyrie eleison. Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison. Any of you said or sung that? Know what that is? Okay, a few of you. And the rest of you, this is why we need to bring back classical education into this world. It means Kyrie eleison, Christe eleison, Lord have mercy, Christ have mercy. Sometimes it's said, sometimes it's sung, but it's like a prayer. And the Greek word for mercy is eleison, but that is not actually what is prayed in this prayer. What this guy prays here is a slightly rarer word. He says, helastatoi moi. What he literally says is, may this propitiation be for me. Now, what on earth does that mean? Every day and every evening in the temple, a lamb is sacrificed for the forgiveness of sins. Two people go to the same service together. They see the same sacrifice, the same offer of forgiveness for the people through a provision that God has given. And one stands there after the lamb has been slain and says, look at me, I'm great. Thank you, God, for making me so much better than everybody else. And the other one stands there, and he beats his chest, and he says, may that offer for the forgiveness of sins, may that be for me. May that price, God, that you're willing to pay to get me out of debt, may that be for me. May this offer of reconciliation that you're bringing about, that there may be peace between us, may that be for me. You see, it's interesting how forgiveness works. We spend so little time in our culture thinking about forgiveness. But forgiveness doesn't simply mean that no one pays for anything. That's not actually correct. Let's supposing I share with Simon Ponsonby, I'm thinking of writing a book. He's written books, and I say, Simon, you know, I love writing with fountain pens, and I'm sort of angling because I know he likes fountain pens and he has some nice fountain pens. And Simon says, you know what, Michael, if it would inspire you, I would like to give you the most precious, valuable fountain pen I have. It was handcrafted in 1783 by the people who wrote the American Declaration of Independence. The kind of thing he probably has. Actually, no, that would be too late, 83. Right? It would have to be about 76. Where are all the Americans in the audience? When was it written, 76? 89? 1789 is when it was written? Oh, 1776, so yeah, the Declaration of Independence, which obviously was a very sad and mournful day for us. And so he gives me this pen, and I, you know, take it home, and I think, this is great. So I, you know, I'm sitting outside, and, you know, I'm not getting on well with it, so I'm sort of like banging it on the thing, you know, why isn't the pen coming, whatever, and then eventually when I return the pen, the nib that sort of used to go like that sort of now goes like this, so you can write in double as you're writing across the thing, and you know, it's a little bit bent, you know, so it's now at right angles, which means you can write around corners. And I sort of say, Simon, thanks for lending me your pen. And I had a slight accident, and here you go. And being a gracious kind of guy, and he's a Christian, so he has to forgive me. He looks at it, and he says, that's okay, Michael, don't worry, I'll take care of it. And he forgives me. Well, that's incredible. That's amazing. That means that whatever damage I did to that pen, and however much it's going to cost to put it right, it doesn't cost me anything. But that doesn't mean no one pays. He pays. He's going to pick up the tab. So that forgiveness, it doesn't come free. Every day, every morning at sunrise, every evening at sunset, God provided a sacrifice, a lamb, to pay the price for what we had done wrong. He pays. And the guy who's in the temple, and after the sacrifice has been made, looks on it and says, that sacrifice for the forgiveness of sins, that needs to be for me. And Jesus says, I tell you that that man, the one who prayed like that, went home having been justified before God. Went home having been made right before God. That's an incredible statement. It means that everything he's done wrong, every bad thought, every harmful experience, everything he shouldn't have done, everything that he should have done but didn't do, God has forgiven him. And now he stands in a right place before God. So there's now peace between him and God. It also becomes the means by which you accept peace for yourself. Many years ago, I was speaking to a guy, and he gave me a long list of questions and said, I'd like you to answer all of these questions while we have dinner. And I looked at them, and there were like 26, and I said, I can't do all of these over dinner. We're not going to have enough time. I said, do you have any favorites? And he said, no, just take them as they come. So I said, let's start with question number one. We got to question number, I think it was question number five or something like that. And question number five was, Michael, you talk a lot about forgiveness. Do you know how hard it is to forgive yourself, let alone to forgive anyone else? And I looked at him and I said, you know, that's a very honest and a very profound question. Not many people are prepared to admit that. But it is hard to forgive yourself, I admit. And we talked for about 15 minutes along these lines. If God knows everything we have done wrong, and he is willing to forgive us, that becomes the basis on which we forgive ourselves. If he has paid, and he has dealt with it, and he has forgiven us, then no matter how awful or shameful or hurtful or difficult or embarrassing it may be, whenever that comes to remembrance, we remember he knows, he saw that, and he was willing to forgive us. It becomes the basis on which we forgive ourselves. That's how we get this inner sense of peace with ourselves. And eventually he said, you know what, I think that makes sense. His next question, question number six, was, I'm basically a good person. Why do I need Jesus? And I said, well, we don't need to bother with this question. He says, yes, we do. He said, because I'm basically okay. I said, now, when we were talking about the first question, do you know how hard it is to forgive yourself? He said, there's something in my life that I'm not prepared to tell you that I'm particularly ashamed of, and that's what I'm struggling with. So he said, I'm basically good. I said, okay, can you tell me what it was that you're not prepared to share with me? You know, when we're talking about question number five, he said, no, I'm not prepared to share that. He said, but I'm basically okay. It took 25 minutes before he finally said, yeah, okay. I guess maybe my life isn't as good as I thought might claim it to be. We're all in need of forgiveness. And when you realize not simply the price that God has paid to make it possible for us to have peace with him and be justified before him and be made right before him and so have peace with him, but also to make it possible for us to reconcile with ourselves and have peace and know forgiveness there, it becomes the basis on which we find peace with everyone else. Because it doesn't matter how much other people have done to us, it doesn't even get close to being equal to the amount of sin that we've committed before God. So it doesn't matter how hurtful or terrible or whatever it is that others have done. That pales into insignificance when it compares to how much God was prepared to do in order to forgive us. And if he forgave us, then we learn to forgive as we have been forgiven. And we find peace with other people. Jesus Christ was the Lamb of God who came into this world to take away its sin. He offered up himself as a sacrifice to make redemption possible, reconciliation possible, forgiveness possible, one with God possible. That is what he did. That's why he came. Now, the outworking of this story is incredible. Two people go to the same service. Two people are in the same place. Two people see the same sacrifice for sin offered. Two people pray, and two people leave. But only one, Jesus Christ said, leaves home having been made right before God. It's the one who was willing to humble himself in front of what God had said and said, that needs to be for me. As you sit here this morning, we're now crossing from morning into afternoon. I am flying to the night to out of the country later today, so this sermon will be finished before 2. As you sit here, where are you before God? Is it possible that true sense of finding peace eternally with God has never been yours because you've never fully looked on the sacrifice that God himself made in the person of Christ, the price he paid for the forgiveness for your sin, and said, that needs to be for me? Well, if that's where you are, then we're going to offer a prayer that you may come to know him. Is it possible as you sit here that you've simply forgotten as a Christian how much you have been forgiven? Bitterness, and you're holding on to anger and unforgiveness against other people, and you're not prepared to let it go. And it's like it's eating you up from the inside all over again. Is it possible as you look on the sacrifice and the price that God paid that you know you need to ask him for a forgiveness of your own heart again and a reminder of how much and he has done for us that you can let go of what's been done against you? Is it possible as you sit here that you're being shut off from true intimacy with God? Because every time you come here, it's almost like you're reminded of everything that ever went wrong. And actually, you haven't yet quite entered into that celebration of being able to celebrate before Christ, not because of what you've done wrong, but because of what he has done to get you out of that mess and now put you in a whole new place. That's why Christians love singing so much. That's why we get so excited. Where are you this morning? One of the great joys for me as I get to travel around the world is to see a lot of people reconciled to God. It's the most incredible thing that can happen. It is the most incredible vision that he has made. It is the most incredible thing that he has done. It's the most amazing price that he's been willing to pay to set us free. It's the thing which changes everything. As I get to travel around the world, my great amazement looking at God is just to be reminded again and again that no matter how difficult we think a situation is, he can actually do something in it. You cannot help but be humbled before God when you see him reach into someone's life who you think maybe is just that little bit too far away, and he does something so amazing and wonderful in it, he ends up putting them in a place where then you just simply dream that yourself could be. That's the God who is worshipped in this place, and it's that God that makes that appeal to you now. He came into this world in Christ, and he laid down his life that we might truly find peace with him.